Back together, you and I, for a busy Tuesday, May 17th, 2022, on Connecticut Today. I wondered aloud when exactly law enforcement will become a bit more proactive in rooting out potential killers, as we learned more and more that there were clues into the alleged gunman's behavior before he killed 10 and wounded 13 in all at that Buffalo supermarket a couple of days ago. We had a return visit on the program for business consultant Dr. Fred McKinney. He talked about the future of Connecticut's legal marijuana sales and whether or not individual municipalities should be able to sell pot as well. What is happening today? The president on the road in Buffalo doing what he has to do as commander-in-chief. We get that. We understand that. But still no answers. And again, Mr. Biden, you may have heard on the news, top of the hour, Mr. Biden meeting with the family and friends and loved ones of the 10 people tragically killed on that mass shooting on Saturday at that supermarket in a predominantly Black and African-American section of the city of Buffalo, New York.
Terrorism, domestic terrorism, violence inflicted in the service of hate and the vicious thirst for power.
And I think obviously we can all agree with that. Mr. Biden continuing.
White supremacy is a poison, and it's been allowed to fester and grow right in front of our eyes. No more.
All right. And the president also taking some veiled shots, I would assume, at the former president and some on the Republican side.
Hate and fear are being given too much oxygen by those who pretend to love America, but who don't understand America.
All right, so here's my question. What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? See, everybody, whenever these things happen, and this is what I mean by, you know, everybody's real concerned for a day or two, but what are the cure-alls here? If there is a cure-all, if there is something that can be done here now, there is something that can be done if people pay attention. If they pay attention. And the situation here is a sticky one. Now, for example, you have to call him the alleged gunman. Obviously, he's a suspect, but everyone knows he did it. But for legalese, you know, he's the 18-year-old suspect. Again, the more you read today, there were warnings and warnings and warnings about this kid. And for some reason, something was not done. Now, everybody who's, again, the tired argument about guns and this and the other, okay, that's being pointed to again today, whatever, that's to be expected. But it should never get to a gun because, you know, people, even young people, they give off a signal. There is a vibe with people when, no matter what age they're at, there is a vibe that something is not right. And we told you yesterday about all these stories coming out about this this suspect in the case, the 18-year-old who last year was put on some sort of a mental health hold for 24, 36 hours. Well, now there's even more coming out about this suspect. There's a large story in the Washington Post. And again, you're going to hear more of this as we dig into this deeper and deeper and deeper. And maybe, and again, people aren't going to like this. Civil libertarians aren't going to like it. This may fly in the face of some of the freedoms that we expect to be given by default as Americans. And it's worth a debate. But, you know, do we, for some reason, or do we perhaps, if somebody is writing online, perhaps, about doing heinous things, or writing things that are overtly racist online, do we employ computer programs to sniff that out and to raise red flags? Because all you've been reading over the past two or three days about this, since this tragic shooting on the weekend, all you've been reading is about, well, they went back and looked at his manifesto and went back and looked at these writings, and they're going back and looking what he was reading as far as uncensored billboards and uncensored forums on channels like 4chan, which has very little, if any, moderation. Well, that's because we want freedom on the internet. Well, is that really practical? And I have talked about this for a while now, and I bring it back up every time we have one of these really bad situations where multiple people are killed, and then like a finely tuned Swedish or German clock, right, we find out the next few days, well, there was maybe a red flag about this, and well, maybe there was a red flag about that, and yes, this gunman, this suspect, whatever, this person of interest, well, yes, you can see in some of their, you know, you can see in some of their internet postings. Well, do we go to perhaps a system? And this is the question I'll start off with today at 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Do we go to even more private sector and government monitoring? I hate to say it, but it may be the only way you can maybe avoid these things. And that's not even guaranteed when you think about it. But do we employ more types of artificial intelligence or what they call sniffer programs if you're using certain words? Now, again, that does fly in the face of freedom of speech. I get that. I understand that. But what do you do? What do you do? Because, again, everybody's pointing to this manifesto this guy wrote, and you could read it online, and he was live streaming this stuff on, I don't know, one of the channels, TikTok or Twitch or something like that. Now, yeah, thankfully that doesn't happen all that often. It happens, but not all that often. So we're in a scenario here of maybe asking ourselves, and you can chime in here at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Are we in a scenario here? Have we reached the breaking point here? In other words, do we need to pull back on things like social media live streaming and the ability of some really sick minds? I mean, because, again, you know, everybody's screaming racism here. And yes, it was a race-focused shooting. But pure racism, I will say it, you know, till they put me in the ground somewhere, hopefully not for a bunch of more years. You know, racism is a mental illness. And had people done more, this likely, maybe, perhaps would not have happened. But how do we get to the we have to do more phase here? I guess that's my question. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Now, maybe you don't do anything with private messaging between person A and person B, but what about, you know, public postings, which are monitored anyway? Is it time to really crank up the monitoring? And I know a lot of people are going to say, well, freedom of speech, this and the other. Well, I guess you're allowed to be racist. There's no law against it. But is it really for the greater good when that stuff is put on forums that can reach hundreds of millions or billions of people with the tap of a finger on a phone or the click of a mouse? And again, my point here is we get caught up, and of course we get caught up on this because that's the main story. We get caught up in the end result. And yes, the end result here was absolutely heinous. There's no debating that. 13 people shot, 10 people killed, and you can have a president, Mr. Biden, or anybody else talking about white supremacy. Well, white supremacy is always going to be there. I'm sorry. In one way, shape, or form, it's been part of this country since the beginning. And it's likely going to be part of this country in a very, very, very small and reduced influence as time goes by, as people mature in their thinking. But how is that stuff magnified? It is magnified by the ability of someone who thinks heinous things and does heinous things, the ability to literally type that out and send that around the world via landline and satellite in a fraction of a second. I can sit here in this studio, you could sit there at home in your kitchen or in your office, or you could sit there at your place of work, and you can literally, you and I can just tap out and type out the most heinous and race hatred filled thing anywhere. Finish it up, look at it, and say, yeah, I'm going to send this out. And I'm going to click send, or I'm going to click send with a mouse or tap it on a screen with my finger, and there it goes. So maybe this is the time where, and I know a lot of civil libertarians aren't going to like it. You know, our buddy, our pal here, Norm Pattis, now noon to 2 on WICC, he may not like it either. It's something we can debate, maybe. But what do you do? Because you have a lot of easily swayed minds out there. And it was one thing where you did stuff by mail, or you stood on a soapbox on a street corner and screamed and yelled until the cops came by and said, okay, pal, that's it. Let's go. Let's go. It's so different now. And also, as part of this story, now he was actually scoping out locales for situations, and yet nobody acted on it, even when they thought he was suspicious. So I don't know what the answer is. Every leader from every locality, every state, every city, every occupant of the White House can talk about white supremacy. Okay, that's fine. Here's my question. What do you do now? Is there anything you can do? I've been fascinated with the coming retail market in Connecticut of legal cannabis sales for regular consumption. Of course, we've had medical marijuana sales in the state for years and years and years. And like Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New York, everybody coming online with retail sales. Although I've had my kind of open doubts and kind of about this lottery process and the equity applications and all that. Welcoming back to the show here, Dr. Fred McKinney. We've had him on before. He's co-founder of BJM Solutions, an economic consulting firm in Trumbull that conducts public and private research since 1999. And he's also the emeritus director of the People's Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Quinnipiac University. Fred, it's Paul here again. How are you? Good to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me again, Paul. I appreciate you covering this topic today.
Yeah, thanks, Fred. And again, I've been fascinated with this, watching the rollout over a couple of years. You had an opinion piece in the Hearst Papers a few days ago, the case for public cannabis retailers. And, you know, Fred, from the outset of this, I said, well, you know, it's good. There's going to be a certain amount of people eligible for these equity applications from over-policed areas. But that's the easy part, Fred, right, to just say this. I mean, you need organization, you need capital. And I'm just, Fred, I'm just kind of wondering how this is all going to work out here. And I read that piece you wrote the other day, and I said, let me have you back on. What are your thoughts so far, Fred, from an equity point of view, from a business point of view, as you've seen this thing shake out so far?
Well, you know, it's trying to thread a pretty small needle to build an industry from scratch that also includes a major component and effort to address the wrongs of the past when it comes to cannabis. Without question, when cannabis was illegal for all of the last century almost, and the first couple of decades in this century, it had disparate impacts on black and brown communities. And so when we have legalization, and now I believe the 19th state in the country to do that for recreational use, I think that Connecticut deserves credit for at least publicly addressing the past wrongs that were done during the illegality regime. But it's difficult to implement a policy that addresses it, I think, the way that Connecticut is trying to address it. And, you know, they've defined social equity applicants as people who have lived in essentially a distressed area, economically distressed area in the state for a number of years recently, or they lived in a distressed area during their youth. And they live in a household that has less than three times the state median household income. So those are the – so it's an income and location requirement that are conditions that determine or define your status as a social equity applicant. The problem with that is that, you know, that definition, it does mean does could whoever wins these lotteries as social equity applicants, they don't have to be black, they don't have to be brown, they don't have to be living in these communities today, and they also don't have to have been arrested for cannabis during any point in their life.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so you look at this, the beneficiaries, you know, this happens in social policy. The beneficiaries may not be the people who were most negatively impacted by the law. And so I that's why I thought, and I've been thinking about this for a long time as well, and I applaud the state for trying to address this, but I think the only real way to address social equity in the communities that were disproportionately affected by cannabis is for the cities, the municipalities, those communities essentially to control the retail business. And because right now the law says that the communities that host these businesses are going to be able to access about 3% sales tax on the product for those communities. And I'm saying, you know what, this is a private solution for a public problem, and I don't think this private solution works.
All right, Fred, hang on. I want to get more into that. Dr. Fred McKinney is the guest talking about the coming legalization. You know, the state says by the end of the year for retail sales, that would surprise me. And Fred's piece, the case for public, as he said, cannabis retailers. I want to get into this lottery thing because I think this thing is a little funny, too. First, though, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. Dr. Fred McKinney continues with us, co-founder of BJM Solutions, an economic consulting firm that conducts public and private research since 1999. Also, the emeritus director of the People Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Quinnipiac University. Fred has a very interesting piece that appeared in the New Haven Register, The Case for Public Cannabis Retailers. You know, Fred, I saw a piece that made me kind of go, oh, I didn't know that. You know, you hear about this lottery, right? The lottery process here. And I think, okay, that's good. You know, people can put in an application. Now, I mistakenly, Fred, thought it was like, okay, one application at a time per company. Then I said, well, wait a minute. Then I read a piece a couple of months ago like, well, they can essentially stuff the box at how many $100 per application. I don't know, Fred, that sounds a little weird to me. What are your thoughts on that?
I think you're right. It's not, I mean, it deviates from what I think most people think of fairness. And I think the concept of fairness, if you really want to make this a lottery and not a contest of who can afford to buy the most lottery tickets, you would have had one application per organization, but the state didn't do that. So as a result, the laws of probability are going to be at work here. It's the people who could afford the most lottery tickets are going to be the ones most likely to win these valued licenses. And so, you know, it to me it's a bad move. And you know, I don't want to cast aspersions or accusations against anybody, but this was not good. And it's not good on the social equity side, and it's not good on the regular side, because what you have is, you know, you have these partnerships that can develop between social equity applicants and essentially investors, backers. And, you know, if you're a backer and you want to, quote, partner with a social equity applicant, well, the social equity applicant, by definition, probably does not have the resources to buy hundreds of lottery tickets at $250 a pop. But their backers might. And so, you know, is it really a social equity winner if they had 100, you know, balls in the hopper?
Yeah.
And some other, you know, poor guy had one ticket.
Yeah, and Fred, the other thing is, now I did read recently, you obviously saw this too, and I think the accusation here that you and I are talking about, I think the state has and the consumer protection people are becoming a little sensitive to this, because I did see a couple of weeks ago, well, you know, I guess, Fred, they're requesting several years of tax returns to look at. But again, you have some social equity applicants that you know may not have filed taxes or are having trouble getting even those records. And I read that and I said, well, there's another curveball right there.
Exactly. Now this, I you know, again, they're trying to build this airplane as it's taking off, and that's a problem. This very, very seldom works in public policy to do it like this. But you know, they're under a time constraint. They're trying to get this market open this year. They're trying to accomplish the social equity piece. They're trying to keep everything above board and transparent, and you know, corruption free. And you know, because you're gonna have losers, and I you know, it's not gonna surprise me if some of those losers of the lottery end up suing the state because, you know, they think that this thing was inherently unfair. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's another reason why this at least for the retail component. The state consider municipal businesses, city-run, owned, managed cannabis retailers. And, you know, that we have experience in this country with municipalities or counties or states or the federal government owning businesses. You know, we have bus companies, we have stadiums, mm-hmm. we have power companies. 47 million people in this country get their power from a city-run energy company. So, you know, the complaint that municipal or public sector companies face is that they are not as efficient. And there's studies, economic studies, that show that that generally is true. They're not as efficient as private companies. They may not be as innovative as private companies. But the way to assure that these companies stay efficient and innovative and competitive is to have competition. And so I would say the cities, the big cities, Bridgeport, Hartford, New Haven, and perhaps some others, if they owned the retail cannabis business in their cities, and I don't care if the state continues to do the lotteries for retailers in other sectors, other parts of the state, that's the competition that you need to keep those city businesses, you know, straight.
Interesting. And Fred, yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, Fred, the other thing here that I worry about, and the guest is Fred McKinney here for a few more minutes. Fred, the thing that I worry about is you read about these states, particularly in Massachusetts, Fred, and also in California, where, you know, they're overtaxing this stuff to the point where, you know, you had the marijuana growers, these commercial marijuana operators in California, you know, approach Governor Newsom out there for tax relief. And it's also keeping the illicit market running in Massachusetts. I think that's something that the state has got to be really careful about here.
Yeah, I mean that's right. There's you still may have, you know, it's ironic that the social equity may come from people that's selling nickel bags on the street like they used
right?
to.
Right, right.
But that's not the goal here. I mean, the goal is to eliminate that. But the only way to eliminate that in a market is that the prices have to be competitive. And the product has to be of high quality. And I think that's the one, the quality issue, I think, is the real one major advantage of the legalization of cannabis, the standardization of what it is that the consumer is buying and knowing that it's been tested and it meets the requirements of the law. You don't get that, you know, from street vendors. But yeah, there's a problem, and I think that if you, you know, there's going to be a problem no matter what you do.
Yeah.
I'm not looking for a perfect solution. There is no perfect solution here, but I do think having the cities control the retail aspect of this business, of this industry, and that's not, I'm not saying that they should be the growers or they should be the transporters or they should be the manufacturers, just retailers. At the end of the supply chain, it's where they have the relationship with the customer, where they can most easily capture the taxes and also influence the other things like employment, you know, there are going to be a lot of jobs mm-hmm. in this industry, and not just in the cities, but throughout the state. And this is your listeners need to understand, this is a significant business. I mean, in Massachusetts, you know, which is our neighbor, which is about twice our size, they're going to be doing this year over $1.2 billion
yeah.
in cannabis sales.
It's a lot of sales.
You know, if things hold the form, you know, this is going to be close to a $700 million a year business in Connecticut when it gets up and running. And so I think that's another reason why the cities should, you know, these cities need help. They need new revenue streams. And I think this could be it's not going to solve the city's problems, all of the city's problems either, mm-hmm. but the cities will make more money, be able to have more impact if they control the retail side of the business in their towns.
Dr. Fred McKinney is co-founder of BJM Solutions. Check them out online, bjmeconomics.com. And he is also the Emeritus Director of the People's Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Quinnipiac University. Fred, good to speak with you again, and we will chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Paul.
Appreciate it. And check out Fred's piece in the New Haven Register, his opinion, the case for public cannabis retailers, cities and towns, selling alongside the private ones.